Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the cost of preventing breaches. I'd like to remind you that the evaluation for this session is online associated with the session. So please fill those out. EDUCAUSE uses that information to provide better sessions for us. Also, one other point of housekeeping. The EDUCAUSE Information Security Council meeting is scheduled tomorrow at 12:45 to 2 o'clock. That's in meeting room 607. So if you can make that, that's a great session. I'd like to introduce our two presenters today. Tammy Clark is the Chief Information Security Officer at Georgia State University, a sprawling urban campus serving over 40,000 students, staff, and faculty in downtown Atlanta. She joined Georgia State in 2000 with the initial charge to start from ground zero in creating an information security program. She's developed a full range of security initiatives. Our second presenter today is Adam Dodge. Adam is the Assistant Director for Information Security at Eastern Illinois University, where he is responsible for the development and maintenance of Eastern's Information Security Program. Adam also runs Educational Security Incidents, ESI. I checked that out this morning. It's a website dedicated to tracking information security incidents that occur within higher education as reported in the news. So please welcome, assist me in welcoming.
Good morning, everyone. Given our culture of sharing and providing open-ended access to our university constituents, the fear of breaches is always upon us, and being a higher ed practitioner for the last 10 years, I've noticed that whenever there's a breach at one of our sister universities in Georgia, or just one that shows up in the news, I'll get a flurry of emails from all over the campus saying, are we protected against this? Are you sure this? We can't be the next guy that's on the 6 o'clock news. And, you know, in talking to Adam and preparing for this session, we just found so much, you know, that there's so much lively discussion that takes place around this subject. And so what we're going to do today is center on talking about the costs of trying to do a reasonable effort at preventing breaches in terms of technology, people, and process. These are some of the topics that we're going to take a look at today. We wouldn't be probably remiss without taking a look at the current threat landscape, what we have to deal with in higher ed, what some of our challenges are there. Additionally, looking at what we've seen in terms of trending around breaches that have occurred over the past 10 years. Another area that we want to look at is how can you use technology, processes, and people effectively to try to assist you with breach prevention. Well, then we're going to get real, folks. We're going to talk about what we see today as trends in higher ed security programs. And we kind of feel like they fall into some phases of development, so we're going to kind of discuss that. Then we're going to hit upon the summary of key points that talk back about how you prevent these, you know, how you can make a reasonable effort at preventing breaches. And then we're going to invite you to share some of your comments or feedback on what you're experiencing at your own university. So introducing Tammy Clark again. When I started the program at GSU, I looked at my job as being a hacker whacker. You know, back then, the hacker groups all operated on the internet relay channel. And it seems like when I had the IDS on there, when I showed up at the university, I saw them getting in. I saw them taking over, say, 35 machines. I would whack them off the network. And sure enough, within about 8 or 10 hours, they were back. They were taking over another 35 machines. I even caught a hacker once on the campus. We had a student, he was trying to get into one of the hacker groups on the internet relay channel so he could distribute his punk music. So he ended up taking over machines in our math lab. Then he was taking over machines elsewhere on campus, and he was sitting in class doing command and control. You know, he was keeping track of all his zombies from sitting in class. So basically, I examined a lot of logs and I got a signature on him and his activities, so I tracked him down. I had to go to the internet relay channel to really get a hold of him because he would never come back to class once he knew that I was kind of on his trail. So when I got to the internet relay channel, I had to work through some of his lieutenants to get a hold of him, and I eventually got him on the line, and he came in to see me, and he showed me, as his punishment, I made him show me how he hacked the machines, and he was using regular Windows utilities. But what I found interesting was his lieutenants that I thought were adults that I was talking to on the internet relay channel, they were 8 or 10 year olds. You know, back then, hacking was fun. We had all the script kiddies coming out there. They would just, you know, the hackers would put a little script out there, and the script kiddies would run some scanners, and sure enough, they would, you know, get the vulnerability. The script would then be given to them, an executable. They would get it on this, you know, the box, and they took it over. So that was basically the threat landscape, you know, back then. You know, but it's really changed now. Well, you know, the hackers got a lot smarter. We were getting better at keeping them out of our network. So they decided, you know how I need to get in? I need to target those end users. And I need to do it in such a way that this university can't really keep me out. I'm going to go through port 80. They can't shut off internet access. You know, so they come in now and they have spear phishing, infected websites, social engineering, all kinds of scams. Now, what I've seen about how this has changed is hacking is not just for fun these days. It's organized crime. And that's really what's taking place out there. If you get an identity, you know, they've said you can get up to $500. So it's a business right now. Additionally, when you look at trying to protect your network infrastructure, the attacks are getting more sophisticated. They're not operating on the IRC exclusively anymore. They're doing encrypted SSH attacks. And one thing I've noticed is that they keep relying on the same attacks over and over. SQL injection, cross-site scripting. They're taking advantage of error. You know, if you're not setting up your server to prevent those types of attacks, you know, they're getting in. They're scanning. They're using that to get in. And all these new exploits are coming out. We're always hearing about something new, and the vendors are having a really hard time keeping up with it. I don't know if you've noticed, but there's a lot of blended malware out there that just gets by the antivirus software. It gets by the firewalls on the desktop. And the next thing you know, there's bots in the network. So this is a big challenge for higher ed. And I'd like to introduce Adam. He is going to talk about the breaches and trends and all that good stuff.
Introducing Adam Dodge, and we had a great introduction. Many of you may know the site, might not know me, Educational Security Incidents. It's adamdodge.com/ESI. It was started back in 2006, actually as a personal research project while I was doing my master's work. I've worked in higher ed for about 9 years now through various IT roles and then moving into security. During my master's work, I wanted to build a repository of case files so that when I went and talked to leadership, I can say not only are these types of attacks possible, they are actually happening to other universities and other colleges in this country, so we need to be aware of it. I actually shared that with the ISO. I was working for SUNY Central Administration at that point, the ISO Ted Phelps. He asked if he would be able to share it with other ISOs at SUNY schools around New York. And that's actually how ESI was born. So a lot of the credit behind this actually goes to Ted Phelps, because without his request, I doubt I ever would have put it online. Like I said, it started in 2006. I go around every year. I monitor a lot of different breach reporting sites. There's a lot of great ones out there. However, there are none that focus specifically on higher ed. I also watch. I have different news alerts set up. I spend a lot of my free time going through these stories, reading about them. And then every year I go ahead and I publish a year in review, which goes and looks at, it kind of tries to categorize these breaches to show where are the threats coming from. One thing, just real quickly on ESI, I don't put the news stories out there to chastise any university. That's really not the point. The point of ESI is to be able to share this information with the higher ed community so that we know the types of attacks that are coming out. We know where our risks are. We know what other schools are suffering, so maybe we need to start looking at those at our own universities. This is from last year's report. Last year actually saw a dramatic increase, not only in the number of incidents reported, but also the number of institutions reporting breaches. And we actually had several last year that where a single breach affected multiple institutions through information sharing, through centralized services between several different like state universities. Just real quick, going through this list here, if we can see, you know, 173 separate incidents last year. Like I said, it was an increase over 2007. If you notice here, unauthorized disclosure is actually employee error. This is information that gets put out on websites that shouldn't be there. This is information that gets attached to emails that shouldn't be there. Information that ends up double stuffed into a mailer to somebody, which happens. Information that ends up in a file cabinet that was sold without being emptied, which has happened. These kinds of easily preventable but not really necessarily technological problems are actually last year were the most frequent type of breach. In fact, if you go through and look at what are just called the traditional hacker attacks, those are what I use as penetration, otherwise known as unauthorized access, it's actually outnumbers them 2-1. Reason for this being, we've done a really good job hardening our perimeter, putting in monitoring in places at most universities, but we need to go that next step. We need to start looking at that end user, and that's where the policies and processes come into place. Of course, thefts are a big problem, and actually the trends are continuing. Now, that 2-1 ratio, which actually held in 2007, held in 2008, 2009 so far, doesn't look like we're going to quite get 2-1. But unauthorized disclosures still are the number one leading cause of breaches that get reported in the news. Please let me make that clear. I'm not trying to say that these are all breaches. I'm not trying to say that I know everything that goes on in higher ed. I know that there are many, many out there that happen that aren't reported, aren't picked up in the news. In fact, I know that for a fact because I know of ones that happen where that happens, don't end up in the news. And, of course, if they don't end up on the news, I don't put them on the website. Another place you can look is Privacy Rights Clearinghouse. They show 38 colleges have reported incidents this year. Actually, ESI is a little higher than that, although I am a month behind, so I do apologize for that anybody that's a regular viewer of my site. Things got kind of busy. And if you can see, you know, thefts, once again, are big. Unauthorized access penetration, unauthorized disclosure here, once again, they're trending very close to each other. You know, so it's not just those external evil individuals that we have to worry about. It's our own people as well, through just mistake and error, that are really causing a big problem at our colleges and universities. So one of the things, obviously, we're here to talk about the costs of preventing breaches, but to start off with, let's talk about what exactly are the costs of a breach. Now, it is very difficult to compute costs due to lack of solid statistics. This is a problem in information security industry-wide. We just don't have good, solid statistics and information. But what we do have is a couple of people that are trying to get that information. One of the most probably known is the Poneman Institute. They release a yearly report. This was the fourth annual cost. One of the things to look at, these are per record costs, $50 direct. These direct are what are called, you know, what you might know as hard costs. Costs of notifications, so costs of envelopes, paper, costs of stamps, costs of getting in outside experts if you need to do forensic investigations. Costs of setting up a call center to handle, like a hotline if you want to set one up, hiring staff to answer emails if they come in, if you have a special email address set up. The other one, the bigger one, are these indirect costs. This is loss of staff time. This is loss of staff time, loss of productivity, some type of reputational loss. Much bigger, much actually harder to quantify. And so that's why I liked this year they actually split them apart. And they looked at the direct costs and the indirect costs. Now, if you look at this, what this means, if you have just a small breach, tiny breach, say 1,000 records, right? I mean, most of us are at universities where our, you know, central information systems have records on tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of individuals. You have something that affects a small breach, 1,000 users. Direct costs, you're looking at $50,000 per the Poneman Institute. Even if it's only half of that, $25,000, even if it's only, you know, 10% of that, you're still looking at $5,000. You know, I don't know about you, I don't really have that much money set aside in my annual budget that I can afford to just kind of keep paying out on these. So breaches do cost a significant amount of money, not only in direct costs, but also, like I said, in the indirect costs. And that's something that often gets overlooked, which is why I'm glad the Poneman Institute covers it. You know, you're all higher ed professionals, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this slide. This is obviously just for people that aren't here, maybe want to pick this up online. But you know, we have a lot of drivers for change in higher ed, and they're not always what we would want, especially with breaches. As Tammy said, you know, whether it's our own breach or something that one of our sister schools suffered, of course, compliance. Red flags, however, I'm getting close to calling vaporware. I don't know if anybody knows it got pushed back again. Compliance date is now June 1st, 2010. and it may get pushed back again and again like it has. But we have a lot of drivers. Research grants, of course, if you're a research institution, that's huge. You don't want to lose those. Budget cuts, you know, in this economic time, I'm sure many of us are facing those. So that gets more difficult. Audits, although audits aren't necessarily the drivers we want them to be, because there could always be that comment to the audit, the university disagrees with this audit finding. Not going to have a lot of luck using that as a driver if the university just flat out disagrees with it. Okay, so emergency risk management, and of course, probably one of the biggest, your presidents, your provosts, your vice presidents, what are their goals? What are their priorities? What are the programs they want? So we have a lot of drivers that we have to contend with that aren't necessarily have anything to do with security. But since we all do have to deal with compliance, I just wanted to show that non-compliance also costs a lot. Again, very difficult. I don't know many universities or colleges that want to go, hey, guess what? We were found not to be in compliance with HIPAA. Look at how much it ended up costing us. This was just some information. So if you look at PCI, probably the most well-known, they actually like to advertise how much they're fining universities. The average fine for acquiring banks, this isn't necessarily the university, this is actually who you go through to process your payments, is between $5,000 and $25,000 per incident. If you don't think the acquiring bank's going to pass that on to you, I wish you luck if it ever happens. So credit card companies, you know, not only is your acquiring bank, but here's what you face as an institution. Credit card companies, you know, they're going to find you. Visa, MasterCard, Amex, Discover. If you expose their credit card information, they're going to find you. Acquiring bank is going to find you because it costs them money when you suffer a breach. Mandatory assessment and controls. Hey, this is fun. Your acquiring bank, if you are found not to be in compliance with PCI, if you have a breach, they are going to dictate that in order to keep processing credit cards, you have to have a mandatory assessment by a certified QSA. And, oh, by the way, most of those things that they're going to come back and say you need, you are going to be forced to put in place. And then, of course, you get bumped up to a level one merchant, which most colleges aren't. Level one merchant status, ongoing, indefinitely into the future. A lot of money there. Quarterly assessment scans, increased scrutiny, very difficult. Just some quick information here. I won't share who. I know one university, they exposed one credit card. One credit card number got exposed. They ended up paying over $80,000 in fines, mandatory controls, and assessment. So the costs there are very significant. So what really seems to be the problem in higher ed? Tammy touched on this a little bit. The open standards, the open-ended culture. But, you know, a lot of universities, especially when it comes to security, security's rather new in higher ed, although there's going to come a point in the near future where we need to stop saying that. We can only hide behind that for so long. But there are a lot of lack of standardization, plans, policies, standards, because a lot of times it is viewed as just an IT role. So, you know, oh, it's computers, therefore all security should be IT-related. Yeah, it doesn't really work. Of course, challenges in data classification, risk management, incorrectly configured servers, devices, apps, and websites, you know, especially if you have a decentralized organization, you have these apps popping up all over the place, you've got varied skill sets between the people that are managing them, very hard to find a common set of standards in which that need to be applied to these, especially if central IT doesn't control the budget, so the departments are able to go out and throw them up. Of course, inadequate perimeter protection. Hopefully that's actually a good one, actually. Hopefully we all have firewalls, which is great. But as Tammy said, they're going right through the holes in these firewalls. The firewalls are not as much protection as they once were. Okay, lack of advanced intrusion detection. That's a big one, especially if you have an on-campus student population. How do you filter your residence hall traffic? How do you even find anything in the mess that is that network traffic? If you've never looked at it, ask your networking staff. It is amazing the types of stuff your students are doing out there. Also, the problem with that, a lot of problems with third-party sites, Facebook, their API drives me nuts because it throws IPS alerts all the time because they put the SQL statements in the API calls. So you are going to get SQL injection attempt alerts all over the place with people visiting Facebook. Of course, lack of encryption, open-ended culture, and of course, security unaware users. Big part about this is not only are they unaware, a lot of times they don't have the skin in the game. There's not a lot of personal reliability being put down to the end users, and that's something that really does need to change. But since we are talking about the cost of preventing breaches and not breaches themselves, can we use technology to assist with preventing breaches? Absolutely. Absolutely we can. Do we have any vendors in the room? Good. If you don't think you can use technology, talk to one of these vendors. They will sell you on anything. There are all types, from network devices like intrusion prevention, firewalls, anti-spam gateways, endpoint security tools. You know, you've got your AV, your anti-malware, your host-based firewall, host-based IPS, your network access controls, your encryptions, your vulnerability assessments, your GRC, your DLP, your IAM, your SIMs, your SEMs. This list goes on and on and on, and you actually can take good advantage of these if you have a plan, because the bottom line is using technology ends up costing you a lot of money, especially if you don't have a plan in place. DLP can be used, but if you don't know how information is being used in your organization, where it's going, how it's coming into your organization, how it's going out externally as well as internally, a DLP system, a data loss prevention system, is going to be very, very expensive and pretty much ineffective because you're not going to know what the alerts are telling you. So yes, technology can be used to assist with preventing breaches, but there needs to be a plan. This needs not to be the focus. This needs not to be the start point. This needs to be the end point of some of the stuff that Tammy's going to talk about.
I don't know what you've experienced at your university, but when you buy and you put this investment in the tools and you saw the 36-karat gold, you know, dollar sign, they're pretty expensive. You know, when you talk about going back to your boss and saying, well, you know, I need additional security staff for all the other stuff, which there is a whole lot of other stuff, they're saying, you know, well, I already gave you a bunch of money when I bought that antivirus system and I bought the firewall you wanted and that IPS. But we're finding that, you know, because we're seeing that the majority of data breaches today are really human error, we've got to approach that and deal with that as being important as part of our security programs, which points to two important costs that often get bypassed, which is effective process development and the active involvement of people across the university. So these are some of the things that we're going to probably have to make an investment in. I will say we'll have to make an investment in if we ever want to take a reasonable approach at preventing data breaches. Process development, putting in place processes that give our users what they need to do to help them protect this information they're in charge with. But what about all these vendors that keep coming to our campus, approaching the faculty members saying, I've got a great new solution I want to sell you, and by the way, I'm going to need some of your data over on my end, and we'll do a little transfer here and a little exchange there. And there's no processes in place, well, you're going to have some big problems there because then you're depending on them to be secure and you've got no protection. Setting standards. A lot of us are looking at standards now because we don't want to guess and just take a guess at what we're supposed to do, but try to get some good best practice guidance about it. And the big one, I think, on this page is accountability. And that's something that Adam alluded to. When you're working in security, you often hear the users say, you know what, I don't have to do anything. That's the IT guy's job. And then the IT guy will turn around and say, no, that's the security person's job. They're supposed to make sure we don't end up on the 6 o'clock news. And if we do, point over at them. They ought to lose their job. So accountability is an issue in higher ed. And we need to spread that accountability around and make it part of people's job descriptions. And lots of security awareness training. We can never do enough. So when I used to go to conferences when I first started my program in higher ed, I would sometimes want to turn my badge around because people would have this kind of reaction to higher ed. It's like, we need to get you guys off the internet. You guys are the wild, wild west. I still hear that all the time. You don't do security. You just let everybody do what they want to do. And I said, no, we do security. We do a lot of security, but we have challenges in getting money and getting attention to our programs. And when Adam and I were discussing this, we kind of came up with three modes that security programs seem to exist in: reactive, proactive, and a new one that we're starting to see surface this year, predictive. So reactive was where I started when I started my program. I'm sure I had that look on my face sometimes when I was turning off 50 ports a day. But, you know, we depend on the end user. When we're in the reactive stage, we're usually starting our programs. We don't have a lot of funding. We don't have a lot of support. We might only have one security person and 40,000 students. Oh, you know what? We might not have any security people. And, you know, we're just supposed to get the security done somehow through somebody wearing 10 or 15 hats. Well, process development usually doesn't take place because there's a lot of incidents. You're running around trying to chase incidents. Because in the technology side of things, they didn't give you much of a budget. I know when I started my program, they gave me, I think, $20,000 and said, you know, secure the entire university. That's pretty hard to do. So, you know, I put the bare minimum in there, which was an IDS. I'm glad I had that because at least I could see the attacks while they were coming in. And when you look at this maturity index that's out there, when they talk about how an organization evolves, you know, when you're in the reactive stage, you're really at the bottom scale of that. You're just trying to survive. You're in that survival mode. So I guess you could say at this point that if your program is in reactive stage, your investment in trying to prevent breaches is really low because you don't have that full comprehensive approach that includes people, process, you know, along with technology. But on the other hand, if you do experience a breach, the impact can be very high. I've seen some stories out there that happened with universities that experienced a breach, and basically they had penalties of $1.5 million assessed to them for PCI violations, or the entire IT staff got fired, and then they hired a consultant and gave that consultant $45 million to analyze the entire university and say, you know what, you people should have a strong security program. Something that the security officer was probably, you know, begging for the last so many years before they met their demise. So the biggest thing I see in the reactive stage is that you've got a lot of unfunded mandates. The auditors are saying, I need a business continuity program. The campus is saying, protect us, but they're not giving you any money. They're saying, well, we have a big IT budget. We can't afford it. So you see all these kind of things, and you're constantly dealing with the penalties of noncompliance, which these days are getting pretty high. Lawsuits, we've had universities that had lawsuits due to breaches. Just all of this big stuff that's going on, including being susceptible to a lot of the malware outbreaks. Back when I started my program and I was in reactive mode, I got hit with the blaster worm, 800 of those. I think it was the spider worm or the SQL worm, we got hit with 1,000 of those. So it was just, you know, you get susceptible to those big outbreaks. And Adam is gonna talk about the next phase, which is a lot more positive.
Okay, so the next phase, and this is really the end goal of what a lot of universities are dealing with, including Eastern, which is why I'm up here talking to you guys about this, and we'll actually get into the Eastern program in a second, is this proactive. You know, it's this emphasis on trying to go out there and find the problems before they become the problems, trying to be out there to watch what's going on. But not only that, you know, it's not only this technical side. It's also getting the adequate resources, getting the staff you need. If you do a lot of in-house development of web apps, trying to get somebody either on staff or an outsourced MSSP that you can do code review through to try to find these problems, try to find injections, trying to find other problems. I'm sorry, I drew a blank there. Before the app goes live, or when the app is live, as quickly as possible before somebody else finds it. Process, this is a huge investment in this point. You need to develop your processes, your centralized policies, your standardizations, your guidelines for the rest of your IT department and the rest of campus. You need to develop awareness training. You know, you need to put it out there. I'm sure everybody here is dealing with phishing attacks because they have skyrocketed this year, targets against higher ed. You know, this is one area, especially with Eastern, I won't go into it too much, that we're really trying to get out there and get the awareness to the end users to stop sending your username and passwords to a Gmail site or clicking on it and taking it to a website over in Taiwan and just blindly putting your information in. We've gotten really good at finding those as soon as they happen, but we want to actually get to that next point of stopping it before it happens. And of course, your technology, yeah, you've got a huge investment here. You know, and if anybody's familiar with the Capabilities Maturity Model Index, while it mainly applies to programming, there can be a lot of parallels that you can draw. So this is to move away from that ad hoc 1-2 no real standardization to an actual standardized program that's driven by policy. So for investment and prevention of breaches, during your proactive stage, your investment, what you are going to spend to prevent breaches is going to skyrocket. Because you're really going from a state where you're not investing that much. There's not that much centralized investment in preventing breaches. The good news is the aftermath of a potential breach, hopefully, once you fully realize your proactive state, is going to be medium. It's not going to be none. You know, we're never going to get away from all the risk. But the breaches that do happen, hopefully, will be those smaller breaches. They won't affect as many machines. They won't affect as many records. You know, you'll find those faculty members that are trying to put that spreadsheet from 1998 with a lot of Social Security numbers in it on the website before they put it out there. So the largest aspects, like I said, you've got a very heavy infrastructure cost. This comes from the standardization, the centralization of the program. Instead of it being this ad hoc, one-off, well, this department's doing X, this department's doing Y, you're pulling it all in to a central security function. So where you weren't spending any money before, yeah, you're going to have a very heavy cost of, in honesty, some of those technologies that we were talking about before. Again, there's going to be a big shift towards moving these standards and these processes into regulatory compliance. Now, of course, regulatory guidance, regulatory compliance, I've always said, should not be the goal of a security program. It should be the byproduct of a good security program. Everybody in here that's a security professional knows it's actually very easy to be compliant with regulations without being very secure at all. So you can use regulation as a driver. Just be careful. But again, it's going to take you a lot of time to kind of shift this way of thinking of your organization. So you're going to have a lot of your time costs and staff costs invested in kind of shifting this thinking, starting to develop these standards. Again, increased standards, risk management, fully functional security programs. You know, if you want to do a holistic, all-inclusive program, that, again, very heavy costs in the amount of time it's going to take you to be there. This isn't something that you're going to be able to do in a year or in 2 years. This is a multi-year project, and you need to make sure that your organization is aware of that, that they are going to be paying these costs, paying for staff, paying for development for quite some time. Heavy reliance on IT org for the information security, or on the information security department, yes. Okay, when you first start to move, when you move from a reactive standpoint to a proactive standpoint, there is going to be a heavy reliance on your security departments. Yes, it's everybody's concern. Yes, I personally believe that your functional IT, your operational IT area should be in charge of those operational security issues that fall within their purview. But when you first start doing this, that's not going to be the cost. So you are going to have to look at how you can burden, how you can handle that, bring that in-house. That's probably going to be increasing your staff if you're able. If not your central staff, it's going to be looking at what kind of outsourced providers you can use. Now, of course, the problem with outsourced providers is that lovely catch-all that you can have with your staff, other duties as assigned, don't apply to your service providers. So when you look at service providers and you look at handling more of this internally, you have to keep that aware. Any additional thing you want them to do is going to come with an additional cost as well. So there are a lot of costs here, not just in technologies, not just in actual physical dollars spent, but in the time it takes to develop all of these, to actually get this proactive, constant monitoring, constant awareness. It's not easy, but it's well worth it if you can actually get there. And again, the reason that I'm talking, actually, I have to update my EDUCAUSE bio. In September 2008, I was officially appointed by the president as the Information Technology Security Officer. This is the first time that a centralized area was appointed to be responsible for security across campus. This is not to say, of course, that Eastern was not doing security, because they have been. I joined in 2007, and before that, you know, they have been doing security. They have been doing investigations. Unfortunately, it was very decentralized. It was really that level 1-2 of that maturity model. Ad hoc, one-off, no standardization between investigations in one department versus another department. Some handled them all internally. Some talked to central IT. They were doing a good job, but from an organizational standpoint, there was a lot of unanswered questions because not all of the information was getting reported up to the CIO, up to the VPs, up to the president, to legal counsel. So that's what I've been working on, migrating to proactive. And again, you know, this is a great time in this economy to start going to the CIO and telling him how much money I need to get us into a better security standpoint. So what we started focusing on first are kind of establishing those policies and standards. Hey, that's great. It doesn't cost us a lot of money other than a lot of my time. But we've made excellent progress in that, actually. We're developing a whole suite of standardized policies that apply to IT across campus. We're actually personally using NIST because, well, it's free. The one word for NIST, though, with any framework, and we'll actually talk about ISO in a second, it's just that. It is just a framework. Don't try to apply this whole cloth. Don't try to apply this without any type of customization. It's there as a framework to guide you in the areas you need to look at, but you still need to standardize it and customize it to your individual area. Another area we're looking at doing is increasing monitoring and situational awareness with the tools we have in place, fully utilizing those tools. One of the areas of this are log files. Oh, I love log files. As a security professional, they are my best friend because they, hopefully, will tell you everything that happened on that box, and you will be able to trace exactly what happened and when it happened and how it happened. This is a big shift if you're dealing with operational IT. Operational IT views log files as only important if there's a problem. They only go and look at it if there's a problem because it'll tell them what the problem is, whereas security, keeping those logs around past the 30 days, past the 2 months, for as long as possible, is great because you're not always going to catch those breaches up front. Situational awareness is another thing. Unfortunately, I'll pick on some people in the room, but I won't mention names. We actually got hit with a zero-day virus about a year ago, brand new. Nobody had seen it before, so our AV was not effective. It hit campus. How we found out about this, and I'm a little ashamed to admit, we had individuals from University of Illinois, we had individuals from Western Illinois University, Northern Illinois University, emailing me saying, hey, I think something's going wrong. We're getting spammed by hundreds of computers at your campus. Took a look at it, yep, about 500 computers on campus hit the zero day. We didn't have really good situational awareness. I don't like it when somebody outside of the university tells me about a problem before I find it. In fact, I get kind of embarrassed about that. So this really drove home the fact that we need to increase the situational awareness. We need to start taking more and more use of these log files, of the IPS alerts. And so we started building that, and we've had really good benefit of this. Of course, this doesn't necessarily give us immediate notice, but you know, we've been able to catch quite a few fissures and quite a few compromised computers relatively quickly, most of them within 2 hours of compromise, and get them shut off, and then do what we need to do. Now, of course, the challenges at Eastern, we have this weird centralized yet not centralized hybrid of technology control. Very, very difficult because I actually work within the central IT. So it's a lot of time getting out there, talking to the different departments, talking to the deans, talking to the department heads, talking to their staff, building these relationships of saying, hey, if you notice something, come on, let us know. We'll help you out. Hey, if you aren't sure what you're doing, talk to us. We'll do a full review of your systems, or we'll go ahead and we'll get into your systems and we'll start monitoring them for you. So that's one of the challenges that we're dealing with, but we're actually having really good results from doing that. In fact, this month I've got to meet with two different departments to start off risk assessments with them and the systems they control, because they, from these conversations, you know, they are kind of starting to get a little concerned, and they want to make sure that they are doing what they should be doing to secure these assets. And of course, obtaining funding, given the current economic situation, very, very difficult to go, like I said, or like Tammy said, you know, hey, go up to my boss. Hey, boss, I need $250,000 for centralized log management situation, because I think it's the right thing to do. So again, working with what we have, I hope to get there in the point we can get these centralized tools, and hopefully the economic situation will increase to where I can get that funding and we can get that money freed up to be able to do these. And now, this brand new one that we're starting to see, Tammy's going to talk to you about.
A lot of us have had about 10 years in developing our security programs and really fleshing them out. No matter what staffing levels we had or budget challenges, over the years we've managed to accumulate a lot of work with technology, people, and processes. So this is kind of a newer phase that we see coming around that really needs to happen in order for us to have a reasonable effort at protecting our enterprises, which is spreading the information security responsibilities across the IT organization and university. Why? Because we've got a lot of admins out there that are managing servers, and they're right now they may not be accountable. So that doesn't give them that skin in the game, as we've been talking about, to make sure their servers are bolstered. But when the CIO is looking at them saying, if that server gets hit, I'm looking straight at you, the finger's going to you, not the security person, sometimes it makes a big difference. Additionally, we got to continue to work on process and inserting the necessary controls into our business processes, take a business-centric approach versus a technology-centric. And we've already put by now a huge investment in technology. We don't need to keep going out buying every new tool that comes along. Let's make the most of what we have. Let's optimize it. So now when you look at organizational maturity, we're moving up. We're starting to get innovative. We've got a lot of process development. So when you look at our investment in breach prevention, while in the previous phase, Adam mentioned that it skyrockets, in this phase it really doesn't. It starts leveling out because you're spreading across the IT organization. You're trying to streamline and you're trying to integrate everything together, so you're really not adding a bunch of new costs. And the aftermath of a breach can be low because you are spreading that accountability across your organization. You're putting a lot of attention to process development, to training everyone. And so you're showing due diligence, especially when you start standardizing your programs. That is one of the big pluses of standardizing under the standard like ISO, is that you can point to that as doing due diligence because it builds a comprehensive structure, and you can point to that if anything happens. So really, the largest impact that you see in this newer phase, security silos start going away. Security is not seen as this little powerful group anymore that is dictating to the rest of the campus. The responsibilities are really spread out throughout the IT organization, and the security folks are focusing in more and more on their core functions and duties. So to give you a little background on that with Georgia State, when I started the program for about the first 3 years, I was in the reactive mode. At one time in that 3 years, I did have a guy working for me, and he was so overwhelmed by the amount of attacks that one day he put a little note under the door saying, I'm outie, and he, you know, escaped. So then, by then I'd been doing a lot of process development, and I was telling the CIO, you know, I am going to need some help. So they gave me some help. I had two people. But we used our time so efficiently that we did get so much done with building out our processes, doing our plan under ISO, getting support from the VPs at the university, doing that business-centric approach and all the relationship building. I got funding when I needed it from getting their support. I also got a lot of process development done. So, you know, we've really been doing good. We started out having 50 incidents per day. It went down to 2 incidents per week or every other week. So we really had started making some inroads. So just when we thought everything was good, you know, I had the 2 people, I even got 2 more people, and I was so happy. We had an IT reorg this year. And in the process of that, we had a consultant, and he was talking about industry pundits, how they're saying that, you know, the security folks should not really be responsible for operational security. Well, my group was monitoring the network for attacks. We were doing operational security. But we have a data center that's open 24/7, and they weren't involved in that. We were also doing all the tactical work. We were implementing and evaluating all the security solutions. Every new security solution that came in, my group was responsible for doing all the piloting, working with the campus, and deploying that technology. So we were involved in that. But the biggest demand that our campus wanted from us and started, you know, telling us was, we want risk assessments. We want security reviews. We want you to help us with e-discovery. We want you to help us with process improvement. We want to make sure that what we're doing is the right thing in protecting all this information. So I kind of, at first I resisted the change that was made, which was the operational stuff left and went is going to the data center. The technical stuff left and is going to the folks that manage the infrastructure. The network group and the people that manage the servers are taking over the tools. And, it, you know, and so now my staff got reduced down to myself and one other person. My other positions went to those groups. So at first I was thinking, you know, this is going to be a new thing. I just had everything going, but I kind of think it's going to work out. You know, this is a new thing, so I can't advocate that, oh yeah, I can really do all of this, but I do believe it makes a lot more sense. And accountability is being spread throughout the IT organization. The CIO has made a point of saying, you know, Tammy is not the person you point to. It's all of you. You guys had better get what you need to get these servers under, you know, under the minimum controls, work with her, get all the process development, and they've scrambled to do that, so it is starting to work out. And I am migrating the security monitoring to the data center, but now my main concern is, you know, do I have enough to do all the risk assessments and security reviews and all that work, that core work that I need to do with this one person, and that's something that I'm going to be evaluating as we go into this new phase. So back to kind of, you know, hitting on the key points. You know, vendors will come to your CIO and they'll say, you know what, CIO, I'll sell you this tool. It'll cost you about $200,000. You're going to be secure after that, so secure. And so then, you know, the CIO gets in this little sense of false security. But yet, the main threats that are out there are targeting end users, human error. So, you know, that part, I don't think there's technology out there that can solve that. If there is, I haven't heard of it. My CIO once said he wished there was a tool that could replace security people, but I haven't seen that tool. So we still have to analyze information and strategize and all of that. And I don't really think we can be accountable for any breaches that occur. You can't point the finger every time at this little security team and say, you know what, you guys need to be fired because you didn't do your job. Because it's everybody. I mean, are we there with the end user when they're clicking on that trip to the Oprah show that they thought was free travel, but it was a phishing email and they put their Visa card in there? I mean, we're not there. We can't stop this. They've got to learn. They've got to be educated. We've got to integrate it throughout. So, you know, in order for us to mature with our programs, we have got to do this funding and ramping up this people, process, and technology. I saw this SANS article the other day where they were criticizing FSMA, and they were saying, you know, FSMA so far has been ineffectual. You know why? You go out and you buy all this technology, you fill out all these forms, and you say, you know what? I looked at that machine. It's secure. But you're still having breaches. You don't have any process. What are you doing? It's not holistic. We know they, you know, they may be revamping FSMA and NIST and redoing that whole structure and integrating it with ISO, because ISO really is around doing all the process stuff, so there could be a happy marriage there. You know, and finally, we need to convince our management, and I'm not going to say this is an easy job. It took me years to do this. But we need to convince our boss, you know, processes and policies and guidelines. Security training is just as important as these tools that you're willing to invest in. You've got to invest in this stuff. If we're going to be successful, we've got to build a community of people that are security aware, because people are causing breaches. We've got, you know, to fix that problem, we have to address the issue with people. And that's really the crux, as Adam and I see it as we discuss this topic. So if you have any questions about this, feel free to contact us. And I think we still have about 5 minutes. If you have any questions or you'd like to offer any comments or feedback based on your experiences with breach prevention. If you do, please speak loud so everybody can hear you. Yes, sir. Well, I think that you have to sell your message to a lot of constituencies, and with being a security officer, you've got to be very tenacious and persistent. I know with HR alone, it took me 8 years to convince them to let me do security awareness training for new employees, but I never gave up. But I found that even with, especially with top management, you've got to keep reformatting your message until it finally sinks in. So that's why we don't get a lot of things done quickly, because they don't always say, obviously don't say yes right away. Sometimes it takes years. But I keep coming back and coming back. And you know, like with my encryption program that I had, I wanted to get encryption. It took me 2 years to sell the CIO. I got a lot of no's, but there was a window of time where he said yes, and I went out and bought it, you know, that same week. So I was going to mention before you, we're just about at a close, this gentleman brought up a good point. There is a lot of free resources on the EDUCAUSE site. I did a supplement to a pre-seminar that I did, Seminar 3A. You can look it up out there. I uploaded a document that talks about building a standards-based information security program. And in that, I put links to all of the EDUCAUSE material that's out there to help you do risk assessments, help you with process development, all of that stuff that you need to do to build a program. And if you have a small staff, don't invent the wheel. Go out there and find this stuff and take a look at it. My security plan is posted on EDUCAUSE. And I put my full plan out there that I developed under the ISO that has the 12 domains. You can use that. You know, anything you find out there, feel free, use that, because it's very helpful. So if you'd like, you know, go ahead and take a look at that material.
I like to call that being in.
We developed an online course using ULearn, which was what the faculty members used to develop training. We developed that course, and we would also share that, but basically it was modules. We developed some modules and a testing scenario to make it easy for people to go in, get into that training with their campus ID, and then they take a test at the end. So that was one thing we did. The other part is in-person training, because people don't retain this information. And you have to keep coming back and finding new ways. Another thing is I use the EDUCAUSE films that the students develop, and the staff love those because they use humor. And they bring it down to everyday levels that they can understand and relate to. So you can use those films, because it says you can use them in your educational development. So that's another suggestion.
The only thing I would add is never underestimate the power of free stuff, people to come.
Well, we're at the end of our session. I wanted to thank all of you for coming. I hope that you got something that you can use at your campus, or some kind of good, stimulated some good thinking with you. And this is the information they put down about those evaluating. You do it online on the EDUCAUSE website. Thank you so much for coming. I hope that you have a good conference.